Welcome to Triangle 411, the pulse that moves the Triangle world today. It's a vibrant collection of stories, medical breakthroughs, what's trending, social good, events, and boundless other adventures. A conversation pit of comedians, authors, chefs, sports figures, experts, the common and the uncommon. Here's the host of Triangle 411, Mary Innsbrucker.
Hi, friends. Gardening. Oh, yes, it's back. It's that time. Gardening, while a joy for many, can also be a perplexing puzzle at times. With us today to answer some of the top gardening questions is Mark Wetherington, the director of the J.C. Ralston Arboretum in North Carolina. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we are sure happy to have you and learn some of the answers to these many questions surrounding gardening. Starting out with one that perplexes a lot of folks, this heavy red clay soil. It's a burden for people really in many places. So what can we do about that?
Well, sure. The first thing I try and tell people when they start complaining about the red clay soil is that it's actually wonderful stuff in that it is just full of nutrients. Mm. It really is. Its only problem is it doesn't drain well. It packs tight, compacts. And so the easiest solution for the heavy red clay is to add some organic matter. And if it's a new bed, you can till in some compost into the whole bed. That's the ideal situation. Many times people are not starting from scratch. They already have a garden planted, and after the fact, they want to deal with that heavy clay. And in those cases, a couple of inches of compost on the top of the soil every year, twice a year if you can, it will help break up that soil over time. Now, one trick that I learned actually just fairly recently with dealing with that heavy soil, if it's a sunny spot, is actually sowing what are called tillage radishes. And a tillage radish is more or less just a daikon radish, you know, those long white Japanese radishes. And you can get the seed from most farm supply places, and you want to get tillage seeds, not daikon radish seeds, because tillage seeds are much cheaper than daikon radish seeds. And you can just rough up the soil in the fall, September or so, sow that seed, and over winter, these big radishes will grow, and they go through, and they're called tillage radishes because they help till the soil. They break through that soil. And then I just cut the tops off and let those radishes kind of break down in the soil. And that adds some organic matter as well. And in a new bed or an existing bed, you can do that a couple times, a couple winters in a row, and will really just radically transform how your soils are doing. And you can do that in a vegetable garden. You can do that just in a flower bed.
That is very interesting. That is one I have not heard of before. And I'm going to have to share it with my husband because he has a few words with this red clay soil. He's, you know, pounding away and, like you say, tilling, or I don't know what he does out there, but it is tough to deal with. So that will be some handy information for him and others listening. I want some more handy information about the ideal time to prune flowering shrubs like azaleas or roses, etc.
So, boy, we get asked this all the time, and it's really a simple thing. People always focus on the individual plant, the azalea or the rose. What you have to think about is, when does your plant flower? So if it flowers early in the spring, like an azalea or a forsythia, that means it's formed its flower buds in the fall, in late summer and fall. So the one time you don't want to prune it is right over the winter. And a lot of times that's when people want to do their pruning. But you don't do that. You wait until they flower. And then ideally you you do any pruning you need to do for those plants in the late spring, within 30, 45 days after they flower, ideally. And then for things that flower a little bit later in spring and into summer, like, say, roses, those you can prune over winter because they are putting on new buds, flower buds, in the spring. There are a couple little oddities out there. The big leaf hydrangeas, the big beautiful blue and pink hydrangeas, they like to mix things up a little bit, and they flower on new wood growing on old wood. So you
what
can
does that
prune
mean?
Those, well, so it's the new growth, but it's not the new growth if you cut them all the way back to the ground. So what you do is you can trim them back. They've got big, fat winter buds. And so I tell people, go back no more than 3 to 5 of those big buds back on a stem and prune there. And then the new shoots will come out and they'll still flower. Now, some of the new reblooming hydrangeas, those were really developed less for rebloom for those of us in the South, but for up in the North where the winters kill the tops back to the ground, and they can die all the way back and come up and they'll still bloom. So if you really like cutting things back hard, make sure you get some reblooming hydrangeas, and that'll kind of take care of that. But it's, you know, I often try and tell people, if you think about the plant, if you look at it, you can often figure out what you need to do for it. And so just thinking about when your plant flowers and paying attention to how it flowers really will tell you a whole lot about what can be done. You know, lilacs, early spring, so you wait until after they flower. Same with camellias. They're flowering over winter and spring. But those early spring, early or midsummer plants, you can prune quite a bit later.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you know, we love them in Disney movies. I'm talking deer. You know, they're beautiful, beautiful creatures. And when we see them in a forest, we're like, ah, it takes our breath away. But when we see them in the garden, the not so quite the warm, fuzzy feeling, you know, that you get like that. So, you know, deer can really destroy a garden. Any tricks to prevent that from happening?
Well, you know, I grew up in rural Virginia, and we had a way of dealing with deer that was delicious. But I live in the city limits, and I'm not much of a hunter anyway, so that doesn't help me. And oh my gosh, my wife loves the deer in the garden. She takes pictures of them and sends them to me. And you know, I don't know if she's doing it to get my blood pressure up, or if she really does think they're that cute.
It's like she's joyous, and your veins are popping. Like, oh my gosh.
yes. And boy, it is a difficult thing. There really is, other than an 8 to 10 foot fence, relatively little that can be done to keep them completely out of a garden. And so, like a vegetable garden, I do recommend people put a fence up around a vegetable garden if they have deer problems.
So how high are we talking about with that then?
Ideally 10 feet.
10 feet?
10 feet, yes, which is not really a option for a lot of people. But it doesn't, you know, it can be a net type fence. It doesn't have to be a real solid fence, but you do want to make sure that deer can see it, you know, so you should have some, you know, flagging tape or something tied to it or woven through it, because if it's just a black, you know, kind of netted screen that they can see through, they'll often go right through it. Now, the deer are all in my garden. I don't vegetable garden. They're all over. So I do have a couple of dogs that You know, I make sure when I take them out that I'm taking them out to different areas of the garden to do their business. And hopefully that helps a little bit, not as much as I'd like. I have in recent years resorted to doing some liquid fence or other deer repellent type sprays out there, which, you know, don't smell very good to us for a day or so. But after that, you don't really notice them, and they seem to work pretty well at keeping deer off of the plants that they most often eat.
What's their favorite? Yeah. What's their favorite? What would be one thing that you would say, don't plant this because it's going to be gone in an instant?
Oh my gosh. Well, they really, really do a number on my Akuba, you know, gold dust plant. They seem to love that. They really go for young dogwoods in my garden. Mm. And I've had other people say they don't have so many problems with dogwoods, but they love to eat my dogwoods. And even some of the plants that they don't eat, some of the magnolias I have, they love to rub their antlers on there and break them apart. I do, with young plants that I've just put in, a lot of times deer will go and want to just taste them, and they'll go to bite them, and they'll lift them completely out of the ground. And, you know, if I don't catch it in time, you know, the next day and get that plant replanted and watered back in, I can lose it. So I do, well, I will often, when I plant something, just cover it, you know, for the first month or even the first season. You know, another one, rhododendrons, any rhododendrons deer just do a number on. I've got a bunch planted. I don't know that I've seen any of them flower because they go right to them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I usually stick to really trying to protect the newly planted things. You know, I'll just take a little piece of hardware cloth and, you know, kind of a chicken wire type thing and put that over a new plant. It isn't too noticeable out in the garden. But I also use a lot of plants that they don't like to eat. Ferns, for instance, are great. They don't mess with ferns almost at all. Some orchids, believe it or not, deer don't eat. And there are some great orchids we can grow outside around here, terrestrial hardy orchids. They're usually expensive, but the deer don't eat them. So it makes them worth the investment for me.
So let me ask you this with that thought right there. And I am not a gardener, so that this might be like doo-doo-doo-doo, like off the planet kind of question. But would it make any sense then to plant? Of course, one could negate the other. I don't know. But like you're saying, they don't like ferns. So could you plant ferns near the plants that they do like? And, you know, that would prevent them from going after those? Does that make any sense? Or
no, it makes perfect sense. And what I'll tell you is, I don't know how well that works. I do that, though.
Okay.
I do that very often. Okay. I'm not sure how effective it's actually been. One thing that's been effective for me for voles, which are another pest that not moles. Moles dig around and make big tunnels, but they're there to eat grubs. They can kill plants by just loosening them up, and the plant dries out because there isn't soil around the roots. But voles are little rodents that go around, and they'll actually eat the roots of plants. And they love a lot of bulbs, like lily bulbs, they love. And so I'll plant hellebores, the Lenten rose, which are poisonous. I will plant my lilies in patches of the Lenten rose, and that really works on keeping voles out. If you came to my garden, you'd see many of my rhododendron are surrounded by ferns and by Japanese ground orchids, and I don't know how well it actually works, but it makes me feel better.
That's right.
I'm doing something.
That's key to life right there. Make us feel better. Okay, yes. Good. Well, you know, I'd like to ask, and I want to hear a little bit about the J.C. Walston Arboretum. I want to share that with our audience in case they ever want to, if they live here in North Carolina or if they're visiting, something certainly they would take in. So let's, time-wise, I'd like to have maybe one more question. I know we talked about gardens for pollinators, but there's an awful lot out there about that. So if you, what is the, like the biggest concern people come to you? Like, what's the main question somebody asks you about gardening that maybe we could cover in brief and then talk a little bit about the arboretum?
You know, it's really one of the real big questions we get is, what can I plant under trees? I've got trees, mature trees, and nothing will grow under them. What can I plant? And to that, there's actually quite a few things. I mentioned the Lenten roses. Those are great under large trees. There's some great sedges, native grass-like plants that really thrive under trees. And that's another one that deer tend to stay away from, although I have found sometimes rabbits will bite off the leaves and line their nests with them, their layers. You know, those are some things. But what, you know, the best kind of way to learn that sort of thing is to come visit gardens, places like the Ralston Arboretum or wherever your listeners are. There's bound to be a good public garden, and look at what they're growing under large trees. Mm-hmm. And this really ties into dealing with heavy soils, but also gardening in dry shade, is plant your plants small. If there's a shrub that I can get as a 3-gallon plant or a 1-gallon plant, you know, container, I will get that 1-gallon container. If I can get it in a quart container, I'll get it in a quart container. Planting small plants they're much quicker to establish under trees and in heavy clay. They're much more adaptable than those larger plants. And they actually, you need to water them less to get them established. People like the big plant because they're like, there it is. I've already got a garden going, and it's tougher because it's bigger, but that's actually not the case. Really works better to plant small. But those are some of the what do I plant in this spot? Of course, I worked at a garden center, and the question always seemed to be, I have a place that gets full sun, except when it's in full shade, and I need a plant that's evergreen and only grows 3 feet tall and flowers all year round. I was always tempted to show them, tell them they need to go to a florist and look at the silk flowers there.
Yeah, it does sound like a bucket list. Wish to get all that in one.
And it's a little more difficult gardening here, where it's actually wonderful gardening area here in North Carolina. But some of the most beautiful gardens are in places like Minnesota, where if it'll live through the winters, everything will flower over that much shortened growing season. And so you get these riots of bright colors for, 2 months in the summer, whereas here things are flowering over, really year round with many of the plants, but even the spring and summer plants that all flower together at the same time in these northern gardens, they may be flowering from late March into October here. And so it's harder to have just, a really intensely colorful garden over that long period as opposed to somewhere up north. So sometimes that's a little frustrating for people who've moved here. And I say, but yeah, you can grow camellias here that flower in the middle of winter, and you can go outside and enjoy them in the middle of winter rather than, trekking through the snow up north.
Mm-hmm. Well, for people up north who might want to visit North Carolina, or for folks that live here and have never been to the Arboretum, give us maybe three or four highlights, and then we're going to have to wrap up here pretty soon. I want to give the folks a link to more information, but go ahead and tell us the main highlights of the J.C. Ralston Arboretum in North Carolina.
Okay, sure. Well, what I would say is, tell people is, we're a research and evaluation and introduction garden. So we have one of the most diverse collections of plants you'll find in the Southeast, or really across the country. We just have so many different types of plants that anytime you come, even if you come often, you're always going to see something different here. And we garden. We do not irrigate most of our garden. We really try and test our plants. So when you see a plant growing here, it's been tough. It hasn't been coddled and fertilized and watered for its whole life just to get it established. So you can really see what will grow and how it will grow. And I would say the other thing that people should be aware of is that we have so many public events in the garden and education programs, and wherever people are, we're doing many, if not most, of our adult programming online as well as in person. In fact, we do a weekly, for the past 4 years since April 2020, we do a free program every Wednesday at 3:00 on Zoom. And we have people who join us from around the country, actually around the globe, for those programs. And then we put them all on YouTube. Our mission is to share information and our passion and our plants. So we want to get it out as widely as possible and try to have as many free programs as we can.
Well, I love that. And that was going to be what I was going to segue into next, because you can hear more about answers to the top questions for gardening. And also, like Mark said, a ton of information otherwise. This particular show on answering gardening questions will run April 3rd at 3 p.m. live via Zoom. But as Mark said, you can also find it other times on the YouTube page, as well as other information. And because, you know, Triangle 411 has a local, national, and international audience, I am so glad that it is available globally, as well as right here in North Carolina. So could you give the site that folks could use to visit?
Sure. It's JCRA, as in J.C. Ralston Arboretum. So jcra.ncsu.edu. So J.C. Ralston Arboretum at North Carolina State University.edu. jcra@ncsu.edu.
Thank you. And thank you for repeating that a few times. It's a lot to take in. And thank you so much for being here today. You know, I'm sure our audience just gleaned a wealth of information, and we're just going to have flowers and plants and everything just popping up all over the place. Thanks to you.
That's fantastic. It's been great talking with you.
I do hope everybody will go to those links. Like I said, globally, you can reach it. So that's what we try to do here at Triangle 411. And unfortunately, that is it for today. It is time to high five and say goodbye. I'm Mary Inspruker for Triangle 411. Today's pocket, spare some change in the world.